Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D Monocle 24's weekly dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. As we transition into autumn here in the Northern Hemisphere, we usher in the season with a global survey of what's going on in the world of design and architecture. First up today, Amanda Levitt's hotly anticipated Museum of Art, Architecture and Technology has opened up in Lisbon. Monocle contributor Simon Tarek pays a visit.
If you think about the generation that born like after the 70s, they all worked and questioned the relation with the architecture, with the space. And now we want to integrate contemporary art in the middle of a really singular and particular building.
Next, Damien Hirst's private gallery has won the Reba Sterling Prize. The Royal College of Art's Harriet Harris joins us to discuss further. Then,
the younger generation doesn't necessarily value artwork on walls as much as, you know, maybe pictures that they've taken themselves and blown up. So I think functional art like this pool table is great.
We head to Brazil to bring you a report from the city's third annual International Design Fair. And finally, Monocle's Chiara Ramella joins me in the studio to tell me about a few design objects that'll keep you warm at the night's drawing. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. Last Wednesday saw the opening of Lisbon's new Museum of Art, Architecture and Technology, designed by British architect Amanda Levitt. The museum is promising to shake up the Portuguese capital's patchy cultural scene with its willfully interdisciplinary agenda, and comes as Lisbon is undergoing huge shifts in its new role as an international city. Simon Tarek paid a visit to the building before it opened to the public and brought us this report.
Drills, saws and hammering are a normal part of Lisbon's soundscape these days, as much of the city is being improved ahead of next year's elections. One of the sites in progress, however, will have a lasting impact on more than just the landscape. A sinuous bunker-like structure is slowly rising along the riverfront. Incorporating 7,000 square metres of new public space, this is the new mega-project by Portugal's energy giant, EDP, which was privatised by the now beleaguered ex-EU president Durão Barroso in 2004. The company today is open to new questions relating to opaque lobbying practices on the part of the former Portuguese leader. Perhaps it's a good thing then that this building, originally envisioned as EDP Foundation's cultural centre, is now called MAT, the Museum of Art, Architecture and Technology. MAT is giving a new space to the established Portuguese art world, while cementing Lisbon's position on the global art map. Curator Inês Grosso tells me more.
We transform a little bit the space of the former power plant that used to be the electricity museum, and we decided to create four exhibition spaces. One will be mostly dedicated to touring exhibitions that we might find interesting when we are like traveling, and more related to architecture and art, the intersections between architecture and art and technology and art. So one is for international exhibitions and partnerships with that we do with other institutions, such as Lightopia that we had until a few weeks ago. It was a partnership, a collaboration with Vita Design Museum. Now we will have the IMS show that was on view at the Barbican in London. And then we have another exhibition space that will be for the collection by the exhibitions, the EDB Foundation collection. Yes, it's a collection that has been formed for 10 years. And it's a Portuguese art contemporary art collection and was never been shown before. So this is the first exhibition. And then we have another space morphed to solo projects with Portuguese as well artists. And we decided also to do the first exhibition in the boiler hall, a space that is really important for the museum and for the building. And this will be a space dedicated mostly to moving image exhibitions. Now we have the Artist Film International, a collaborative project initiated by Whitechapel in 2008. But we can take a look and then I will explain you more.
The boiler hall, which displays all the machinery from the original power station, today also houses video art and film work in between the pipes and levers. It's a space that appeals to educational school visits as well as experimental filmmakers. Hard hats on, Inés and Felipe Sanchez take me through the impressive site of the new building, designed by British architect Amanda Levitt. For decades, a busy dual carriageway and railway line have divided river and city, Now, a new bridge that curves over the road and tracks will bring visitors to the museum campus, right over its roof, which will also be a site for performances and cinema screenings in the summer. A skin of porcelain tiles across the cantilevered structure reflects speckled sunlight off the river and into the museum and the restaurant. It's easy to imagine young Lisbon skaters occupying the rounded facade that underneath will house some impressive names.
And here we are entering now the Oval Gallery. It's the main room of this new building, the most iconic room. And here's where we'll be organizing, presenting the show by the installation by Dominique Gonzalez Forster.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're already working on the install. So it's like 1,000 square meters in total. And the main purpose of this room is to show big installation, big exhibitions by solo artists. And it will work a bit like the Turbine Hall, where you have a free entrance. You don't need to pay to see the works there. So here it will be like that as well. So this will be free entrance as the roof and as all the surrounding area of the museum.
The contrast between the old power station, a red brick structure that had little to do with the surrounding urban space, and Levite's new ambitious topography is a striking one. But I'm still not sure what really makes this museum a go-to point for the multidisciplinary fields it makes claims to. Rather, it seems like a new stop for the blockbuster shows doing the rounds around the world's museums. The Lisbon Architecture Triennale's main show, The Form of Form, will be shown here in a matter of days. But that is only once every 3 years.
We won't be doing exhibitions on architecture. You know, it's a contemporary art museum, and people get a little bit confused with the fact that we say, because it is, look, it's, for one hand, we have these two buildings. One is like a piece of a really known and recognized architect, Amanda Levite. The other is like a really important building because it's a historical building. It was also classified. It was really important for the city, even in regards to technology. So we decided to bring this to, it's not to do exhibitions on technology, even if today is almost impossible not to do it. If you think about the generation that born like after the 70s, and even before, if we think about Cabrita Reis, they all worked and questioned the relation with the architecture, with the space. And now we want to integrate contemporary art in the middle of a really singular and particular building.
MAT is billed as a public project built with private money. Despite its merits as a new accessible cultural space for the city, he is hoping that inside it is more than just another mega museum for big names.
That was Saima Tariq reporting from the Museum of Art, Architecture and Technology in Lisbon, which opened last Wednesday. We're going to stick with architecture now. Reba's Stirling Prize, the foremost prize in British architecture, was awarded last week to Caruso St John's Newport Street Gallery. It houses Damien Hirst's private art collection. Earlier, Harriet Harris, senior tutor in interior design and architecture at the Royal College of Art, joined Monocle's Emma Nelson to discuss more.
One of the most interesting things about it, though, is it was listed. So there were some constraints about what could be done with the building. But you've got quite a tricky client. You know, Damien Hirst is not renowned from being straightforward in any way creatively. But I think one of the most interesting things about the building is so many signature architects feel they need to do something, I don't know, fairly typical everywhere. So you've got Zaha with her bicycle helmet curves, which he superimposes onto stadiums or onto velodromes or swimming pools. And then you've got the Frank Gehrys of the world who just love to do anything that resembles a crushed Coke can. And what you've got with Caruso St John is a real understanding about minimalism, about detail, and about a real purity to the materials that they use. The infamous architect and late great architect Louis Kahn, American architect, once said about bricks, if you really want to know what a brick can do, ask it. And in a funny kind of way, I think that's what they really did with this building.
It's actually three buildings that were pre-existing by a railway line in Vauxhall in London, which is what can be described as up and coming, still quite a hard place to live in, but extremely expensive, as all of London is. So there's this whole question of gentrification and imposing an identity of a new place inside a very tight-knit community. But the fact that they took these three buildings and effectively glued bits on each end, she said in the most architecturally precise way that she knew, but without actually changing the real feeling of the building, it's quite an impressive job, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at the moment, obviously, there's a bit of a spectacle going on with the Keith Haring exhibition, which has made it somewhat kitsch inside. But I think one of the key things is understanding the nature of circulation and light, making it something that could be engaging for the viewer, so it doesn't feel necessarily that it's really a conceited building, that it's just celebrating its opulence and its identity. I think also that we have a big challenge with culture in central London. So many of our key artistic institutions are sat right in the heart of the city, whereas this, even if it is in an area where there could be accusations of gentrification levelled against it, at least art and culture being brought and integrated into a kind of, you know, more modest site.
One person rather churlishly mentioned, I'm not one to read the comments at the bottom of an article on the internet, but this one did catch my eye. It just went, as predictable as the art it contains. Would you agree?
Sadly not. I think it's not bombastic. You know, it could be easily overlooked, but I definitely don't think that it in any way is, for once, not something that has an aggressive imprint on the city. There's so many buildings that, if you like, at the moment, that we define as being London that offend so many people, whether it's the walkie-talkie or the Shard. These aggressive statements of architectural importance are the things that I think many of the public are actually resisting and having a real problem with. So this sensitivity, I think, is very welcome right now.
Who do you think this award was for?
Well, it's architects celebrating themselves very much. And I'll be honest about this as an architect. What you have on the BBC is obviously the voting, and what you have is 36,000 people, which isn't even 2% of the British population, voting on this award. And the one they recognised wasn't this one. In fact, this was the least popular choice, according to the British public. They were far more interested in what I'm calling the ideal retirement home, which was an artist studio designed in the rural countryside for two ageing artists who wanted a studio space and effectively a nice, accessible bungalow somewhere very rural. And that's wonderful. I mean, I wish, quite frankly, that all old people's homes could look that marvellous. And I did find it curious that they wouldn't disclose the cost of this project when all the others did, in fact, quite openly. But that was the most celebrated by the British public building out of all of these. And then the others were, I think, a bit more of mixed palette. You had, as always, the good old university buildings being celebrated. And there's a reason for this, because universities have now been privatised. So there's a lot of speculative development now. We've got a little more money to spend on these buildings. But the most controversial of all, of course, is the Haygate estate, which is now called Trafalgar, which just sounds dreadfully colonial. But it was traditionally a working class estate that, in order to generate the revenues to redevelop it, had to decant, and this is always a curious euphemism that local authorities like to use, it had to decant its working class population and leave only a tiny slither of that indigenous crowd and actually sell off many of the buildings as private property in order to generate the revenue to do the redevelopment.
How relevant is Reba, the Stirling Prize now? You mentioned the fact that the majority of the British people wanted somewhere nice and cosy to retire, which is understandable. But how relevant is it globally now?
I'm not so sure. You know, there are awards all over the place. And in fact, some of them are more controversial than others. Obviously, we have awards that don't recognise the diverse population of society. And even within architecture, there are very few that recognise the contribution that female architects make, for example. So I think awards in general always come with a concern. And I think with this particular award, the concern is that are we really just celebrating aesthetics, or should we be celebrating other things? Perhaps we should be, if you like, nominating and rewarding buildings that do make a choice that's responsible socially and not just aesthetically towards a community. And I think that in this particular shortlist, that hasn't really been achieved.
Was there any building on there that you would have said, actually, this serves a positive long-term social purpose?
Strictly speaking, not really, because in fact, these are all private spaces, rather sadly. I mean, universities supposedly are public, but we know in truth that they aren't public buildings. So I think, rather sadly, the closest one that comes to being a public space is obviously the gallery.
Harriet Harris there, Senior Tutor in Interior Design and Architecture at the Royal College of Art. This year, for the second year running, IDA, Rio de Janeiro's International Design Fair, set up its stall within the city's annual art fair, Art Rio. Monocle's Rio correspondent, Sheena Rossiter, met some of the designers at IDA and saw how a taste for design art is emerging among the country's younger generation.
There's a constant buzz in the air here at Art Rio, one of Brazil's largest art fairs. As art lovers here weave their way through all the nearly countless galleries with artwork for sale and on display here, tucked away at the back of it all, the grand finale of the whole fair is IDA, a separate design fair. Brenda Valanci, the curator and director of Art Rio and IDA, explains why she decided to add on IDA to an already existing art fair.
What we saw is that people started buying art, and then after having a house full of art, they start looking for the furniture as well. And they wanted a furniture that is signed, that is done with a thought.
Yes, the younger generation of Brazilians are attracted to design, both in terms of style and function. But this is really a long-standing practice in the South American nation. Brenda Valanci, again.
We have this tradition that happened with Sergio Rodriguez, with Tenreiro, with Zhao Zupin. We have a bunch of designers. And since they were so focused in their production, I think that went through the young generation, and Brazil really has like a aesthetic eye to the furniture and these kind of things. That's why design is so well received.
And in this young generation that Brenda Valanci is talking about, there is one designer who is leading Brazil's new generation, Zanini Gizanini. At 38 years old, Zanini Gizanini is a continuation of a family tradition. The son of legendary designer José Zanini Caldas, who was better known as the master of wood for his furniture designs that used a lot of Brazil's ipê wood, Zanini Gizanini, who, unlike his father, is formally trained in design, is making a move away from predominantly using just one material in his design. Several studios here are carrying Zanini Gizanini's work this year at IDA, but he wants to show me a few pieces he brought this year to the fair. Over at the Mikalsan, where some of his work is on show for sale, he shows a large steel dinner table made actually from a material that's called inox, a metal compound commonly used to make kitchen sinks. Sitting side by side with some of his father's classically designed ipê wooden chairs, the inox dinner table, mirror, and sofa look cold in comparison with their sleek silver futuristic-like designs. But this new combination of material, as Zanini Gizanini tells me, is actually part of a new sustainable movement in the design world. He tells me that the base of all the furniture that he's designed here, even though you can't actually see it, the structure on the inside of the inox metal is actually made of recycled wood. And the metal is then cast on top of it to make it hold for a long time. Zanini Gizanini says that using different materials and more recycled materials is the way designers work now. After a lot of the wood that was used by the previous generation of designers in Brazil is no longer available. Two stalls over from Zanini Gizanini's work, I meet Ronald Sasson, who hails from the south of Brazil, the main base for many of today's Brazilian designers. His work also goes along with a new school of thought by combining materials. He explains one of his pieces.
It's a bench. It's made in iron. It calls Kansai. Kansai is a place in Japan. They make bamboo stuff, bamboo. Inside it's brass. Outside it's a Brazilian wood called goiabão. It's a limited edition of three pieces. It's very hard to do. I love that piece. I love it.
How long does this take you to design this one piece? You said it's very hard to do. How long does it take?
From the first draw to the end, almost 6 months. only to do the fabrication, it's 28 days.
Indeed, sustainability is a big theme here this year at IDA, and this can be clearly seen at local Rio de Janeiro design studio OBJ. Here, I'm looking at a piece by designer Mauricio Achier, who is a Brazilian designer, and he basically combines functionality with sustainability. By using recycled wood from already demolished trees, he basically combines both a dinner table and a pool table for fun at the end of the night. You simply take two panels and place the panels on top of this already cleverly designed pool table, and you can sit and have your dinner. And then at the end of it all, just simply take them off, and you can have a game of pool over a few beers or a glass of wine. As I make my way through the design studio stalls, I meet Canadian Cynthia Barker, who's among the design lovers at IDA. In her 20s, she is in the new generation of buyers here, and she agrees that the younger generation of art collectors has a change in perspective, which is valuing design art more and more.
I mean, I think it's definitely great to have functional art, especially when we're living in smaller and smaller places and our money's tighter and tighter, and the younger generation doesn't necessarily value artwork on walls as much as, you know, maybe pictures that they've taken themselves and blown up. So I think functional art like this pool table is great, or like the tables around here, because they're beautiful and people like to be creative and expressive, and this way you can show it in their house.
Even with a generational shift and a change in lifestyle in young art and design collectors, Brazilians are still proving to have an appetite for design in Rio de Janeiro. And IDA will continue to be around to feed it with a young generation of designers. For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Sheena Rossiter there reporting from IDA Design Festival in Rio, which ran from September 28th to October 2nd. Nearly time to say goodbye for this week, but before we do, Monocle's Chiara Romella joins me in the studio, and she's brought along with her a selection of design treats, guaranteed, she's told me, to keep you warm as the nights draw in. Chiara, welcome. Thanks for joining me. What have you got first up?
I have a selection of three things, but first I wanted to ask you, how do you feel about autumn? Are you an autumn guy?
I have warmed to autumn as I've got older. I used to be quite dismissive of spring and autumn, the kind of between seasons. I was a big winter and summer guy.
A guy of the extremes.
But I've come to appreciate the transitional seasons now in my old age. And I I'm a big fan now.
I used to consider myself a bit of a summer person, but actually I think autumn is a season that lends itself very well to design. I think it's a very design-prone season. And I say that because the entire point, I guess, of having a well-designed home is a home that you feel nice and comfortable in. And there's nothing better to feel nice and comfortable. That's something that makes you feel cozy. A blanket, a kettle, a candle, you know, all those little elements that actually turn a house into your proper home. And people who've read our book about cozy homes, I think, get an idea of what I'm talking about. So I think my spread of our autumnal wares will really give that feeling of cocooning. I like the word cocooning. To whoever would like to just take their little time this season.
Some objects to hibernate with, is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly.
Go on.
So first up is a stove that I've seen just last month at the design fair here in London. It is by a company called Albert's, Portuguese company. A very interesting one, actually, because it was founded long time ago, in 1929, and then produced some incredible designs for public use as well as private use, including, you know, benches for the outside and lampposts and even fire hoses, and then eventually came to an end in 1990s and was revived eventually in 2009. And from an archive that used to comprise 700 products, now they only make 12. And one of them is this new stove, which is a very bulky piece of work. It's a beautiful thing. It's a kind of a squarish shape surmounted by a cylinder, and it has a side wood basket that's very minimal, which can be combined with the stove so that it can sit either next to it or underneath it. And it's a beautiful thing, and it does only weigh 200 kilos, so I think it's pretty portable.
I'm not sure if that's, you know, a lot or not a lot for a stove. I'm not au fait with stove weights, average stove weights, but it is a beautiful bit of design. It's a bit kind of log cabin, but it's also quite sleek, quite minimalist, quite sexy. And I think they're the two aesthetics which aren't frequently combined, but it looks very good. Obviously, you've got to have the wherewithal within your own house to be able to install it. But for those that do, lovely. What else have you got?
Well, next we head into the domain of blankets. So the company I'd like to talk about is called Hilary Grant. The designer Hilary Grant is based in Orkney, so she knows a thing or two about cozying
up. It being cold and dark for a long time.
And you kind
and
of having
to be under a blanket.
Yeah, and you wanting to have to resort to beautiful things to kind of cheer yourself up. And she makes really bright and really fantastic woven textiles from blankets to scarves and hats, actually quite a rather cute one with a pompon on top. But I like to talk about the blankets because they have quite geometric kind of graphic patterns. And she says that obviously she takes some influence from the Scandinavian tradition, and obviously knitwear is like a major element of kind of the Scandinavian winter. But also she draws inspiration from the colours and the patterns of Scotland. She says that she goes quite often to Glasgow and therefore kind of looks out of the window and picks up on the patterns that occur in her own Scotland, which I think is quite beautiful.
And what's your third and final product for us this autumn?
So I don't think we could do without a great kettle. And this one, I think, is really great because it makes us think about the way that we live in our homes and not just about the fact that it's rather beautiful. It is. It is designed by Keren Hu, who is a Korean graduate from the Royal College of Art here in London. And I saw this design in the wonderful shop / gallery in West London. And the kettle is quite minimalist. It comes in either white or black, and it's a rather classic shape with quite an ample handle.
Ample handle, quite a narrow spout. Nothing wrong with that. Just observing, trying to paint a picture in the mind of the listener.
I think you're definitely right. There is an issue of narrow spout there. But also, if you see the kettle next to a person, you'll realise that the kettle is much smaller than what we're used to thinking about when we think about a kettle. And that's fundamental for the design of this, because the designer thought about the fact that appliances have traditionally been designed for the kitchen, and that's why they're normally called kitchen appliances. But people don't just use them in the kitchen anymore, partly because spaces are blurred, because spaces are becoming smaller and smaller. So people maybe share their kitchens and their kitchens become also living spaces, and sometimes bulky items, noisy items can not be what we need for extra functionality. So this kettle is made so that it can work in a living space, and it's smaller because it can brew just 1 to 2 cups of tea, so it boils quicker than your usual kettle because it just does what it needs to do. And I think it's just an interesting way of thinking small about the bigger problems that we have right now in our way of living in cities, really.
Fantastic. Three products there from Chiara Miller to keep you warm this autumn. Chiara, thank you so much for joining me. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop me an email. I'm at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. And please leave us a review on iTunes if you get the chance. It really helps people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. And until next time, it's goodbye from me.